KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. Welcome to Speakers Forum. We bring you talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. Here in the Northwest, we take pride in our regional seafood industry. But details about the big picture of seafood distribution may surprise or appall you. Our guest this week is Paul Greenberg, author of the book American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. In it, he urges us to, quote, build a bridge from the plate back to the estuary. This requires us to not just eat local seafood, it requires the establishment of a working relationship with salt marshes, oyster beds, the natural flow of water from river to sea, and the integrity of the ocean floor. The U.S., which controls more ocean than any other nation, imports 91% of its seafood. Paul Greenberg spoke at Town Hall Seattle on July 10, 2014, as part of their Civics series. Thanks to Sam Kohler for this recording.
Thank you. It's always kind of amazing for me to be in Seattle. It was a mythical city for me as a child. This is where my father went through basic training as a psychiatrist in the Army. And they sold tickets. The enlisted men sold tickets to watch the doctors go over the obstacle course. So I always think of, like, well, if my dad could do that in Seattle, I can do this in Seattle. The Fulton Fish Market was at one time the greatest fish market possibly in the world. Millions and millions of pounds moved through it. And it was a sight to behold even in 2005. It was disgusting. It smelled horrible. There was cigarette smoke everywhere. But it was also deeply atavistic. There was all sorts of hand signals and shouting and whistling. And everybody seemed to be named Bobby. So, you know, you go over to one guy and say, do you have any tuna? No, you want to talk to Bobby D. Well, who are you? I'm Bobby P. So you work your way around the Bobbies. And there would be, it was just such an interesting crowd because there were restaurateurs there who were picking up entire pallets of salmon. And then there'd be the occasional elderly gentleman who would sidle up to a monger he'd known since 1950 and walk away with a single fillet of sole. It was just a really, really nice environment. There was all sorts of things wrong with the Fulton Fish Market. Giuliani had been trying to get rid of it for years. It was said that the mafia charged you several hundred dollars to move your fish from one block to the other, just across the street. Cigarette smoke everywhere. Every ordinance it could violate, it had violated. But I loved it, and it was a really exciting place to be. So I kind of made up my mind that I was going to really embrace this market and was going to be part of my sort of morning routine and so forth. And a few months later, I decided to get on my bike again, and I really wanted to kind of understand this island of Manhattan, this place that I lived, and I wanted to understand it not just as a place of glass and stone and rock. I wanted to know it as an ecosystem. So I got on my bike, and I headed up the West Side Highway. And for those of you who have some long history, know that in New York, once upon a time, there was a plan to pave over a huge part of the Hudson River waterfront with something called Westway. And had it not been for fish, actually, it would have happened right after the Environmental Protection Agency was founded, right after all these great things like the Clean Water Act came along. It was discovered that in the piers that abutted the Hudson River waterfront, there was one of the last really healthy populations of spawning striped bass, and the striped bass turned the tide, and now that whole stretch of property is a park for the public. So that was this really amazing thing. I was biking up. I went all the way up to the top of Manhattan. I wheeled my bike through Inwood Park past New York's last salt marsh. New York used to be surrounded by salt marshes, but there was just a little patch then. And I kept going and going, and I went down the East River, underneath what I kind of conceive of as the triple necklaces of New York, the Williamsburg Bridge, the Manhattan Bridge, and then the Brooklyn Bridge. And I was really excited at the end to see the Fulton Fish Market again. But what I found was this. It was gone. The Fulton Fish Market had been closed. It was 2005. And after a long struggle with the city, they finally took the last waterfront market from a city that once had 14 waterfront markets and banished it to a far northern outpost of the Bronx. And later on, I would go up there and visit with Bobby and Bobby and Bobby. And I was talking to one of them, Bobby, and I said, what do you think about it up here in the Bronx? And he said to me, you know what happened? You know where the city put us? Up here. They knew where they had been stuck. And these tremendously kind of, you know, brawling big Italian guys in this new modern warehouse, they looked like they were about that big. In the old Fulton Market, everything was to scale and people looked right and big. Here they looked shrunk down. During that time that I was up visiting the fish market, I had also come up against an interesting statistic, which very much paralleled the disappearance of the market, which is that the United States controls more ocean than any country on Earth. 2.8 billion acres of ocean, more than twice what we have set aside for land food. Amazing, amazing resources. But I found out at this time, as I was starting to wonder about the seafood picture in this country, where our seafood was coming from. And it turns out that more than 80% of our seafood is coming to us from abroad. And at the time, that statistic had just sort of reached me, and I was really thinking about it, and I was up at the New Fulton Fish Market, and I happened to come up across Herb Slavin. And Herb Slavin, if anyone's from the fish business here, he was like the grand pasha of the market, and I'd heard rumors that he used to lie on a fainting couch at the old Fulton Market, and people would come by and make offers of fish. He was, yes, no, yes, no. So I was really kind of scared to meet Herb. I'd actually heard about an altercation Herb had had with a shrimper where somebody ended up with an Uzi machine gun in his mouth. They each had different stories about who had the machine gun and who had the mouth. But in any case, yeah, I was really nervous to meet him. And I met him. He was about this tall, stocky guy in an apron. So I said, Herb, what do you think about the fact that, you know, more than 80% of our seafood is coming to us from abroad? And without missing a beat, he goes, who's the broad? And that became sort of a quest in this new book that I was working on. So who is the broad? Where is all this seafood coming from? What is it? What's going on? Well, if you look at the sort of top six seafoods, number one, what stands out immediately is the amount of shrimp that's coming into this country, 90% imported, and just coming from all over the world, but mostly from Southeast Asia. Next up, canned tuna. Again, most of it coming to us from abroad, from all sorts of countries under all sorts of regulation. It should be noted that a lot of tuna is coming to us actually illegally. When you look at the vast scope of all the imports that are coming into this country, half of the imports coming to this country are wild, half are farmed. Of the half that are coming into this country that are wild, turns out about a third of those imports are caught illegally. In other words, stolen outside of any management system whatsoever. Number three, salmon. Okay, well, here I am in the salmon nation. You know, great. We should be, you know, salmon, at least salmon, that should be, you know, all wild and ours. But it turns out this is the thing that throws the really weird wrinkle into the system. So we actually export around as much salmon as we import. The salmon that we export is almost entirely wild. And the salmon that we import is farmed, coming to most of it, well, the majority of it coming from Chile. And it's interesting, coming from Chile, which is in the southern hemisphere, and there actually are no salmons or trouts native to the southern hemisphere. In fact, the equator acts as a thermal barrier, which prevents any salmon from ever being there. So we have actually introduced a huge amount of invasive species to the southern hemisphere through the culture of salmon. And here's one more really weird thing about the whole salmon situation. A certain portion of the Alaska salmon catch gets caught by Americans, frozen here, sent to China, defrosted, boned, filleted, sent back to us refrozen, and then arrives and limps into port twice frozen. How's that for food miles? Kind of amazing. Number four, Alaska pollock. That one actually is from our country, but we're also sending 600 million pounds of Alaska pollock a year abroad. That gets rendered into all kinds of things. It becomes fish sticks. The filet of fish sandwich is actually Alaska pollock. People know what it is. That fake crab that Larry David complained to his wife about during sex, that is actually also made out of pollock. It's the most eaten and unknown fish there is. But meanwhile, so we're sending 600 million pounds of Alaska pollock abroad. But in the other direction, we're getting farmed fish that enter into a similar niche. Number four is tilapia. So tilapia is this fish that, like, who ever heard of tilapia 20 years ago? I was talking to an aquaculture guy here in the States, and he told me that the first time he'd heard the word tilapia, he thought it was a stomach disease. But it's not a stomach disease. It's actually a very efficient fish. It grows from egg to adult in something like 9 months. It eats everything. If they get into a pond where the temperature doesn't fall below 60 degrees Fahrenheit, they will take over the entire pond. And indeed, in many parts of the tropical world, tilapia have just done just that, taken over pond after pond after pond. The last fish on our top six list is the Pangasius catfish. So this is a fish that probably nobody really knows if they've eaten it or not, and yet it's the sixth most popular fish in America. The reason is that this is the fish that when you go to, say, if you end up in a hospital, and the orderly comes by, and she says, "What would you like, chicken or fish?" And you're like, "There, your appendix has been removed," and you're like, "You like something light." So you say, "Well, what's the fish?" "I don't know, mister. It's fish." That's Pangasius. So Pangasius is interesting because it's a catfish, not kosher. It's a catfish, grows really fast. And I've been to the Pangasius ponds in Vietnam. The amazing thing about Pangasius, you can just cram them into a pond, literally fish on top of fish, so much so that when you approach a pond, it looks like an M.C. Escher painting, like, you know, those interlocking things like this. And even to the point of transformation, you remember the M.C. Escher thing with the fish, and then they eventually turn into ducks? Well, so this is what you did in college. Whoa, M.C. Escher. Younger people don't remember this, but that's what college was like. There was no computer. There was just M.C. Escher. But anyway, so what's really crazy about these Pangasius catfish is that they're piled up fish on top of fish on top of fish. They oftentimes will go through their oxygen supply, and when they run out of oxygen, they stick their weird little mouths above the surface of the water, and they take a breath. Yes, they can breathe air. So it's very weird. But again, you know, from an ecological perspective, if you're looking for a good farmed fish, kind of fits the bill. But I think that most of the people in the hospital, given the chicken or fish choice, knowing what the fish option truly was, might go for the chicken. So anyway, so that's sort of the summary there. It's not kind of broken out like this in the book. It's more kind of to kind of position you guys and sort of understand what this whole picture looks like. What the book really focuses in, and I'm not going to go into too much detail of what the sort of guts of the book are, because you're going to buy the book afterwards. I was talking about this at Powell's yesterday, which it's very hard at Powell's to make a convincing point for a book, because you're holding up your book and it's one of like 10 billion books that are at Powell's. It's very, very intimidating. But the case I made for buying a hardcover book is, look, that hardcover book represents, like, how much does a movie cost in Seattle now? $10? $15. Thank you. All right, so it's an even better deal. Look at it. So for a movie, you buy the movie ticket, you get 2 hours of entertainment for $15. I guarantee you cannot read my book in less than 10 hours. So by that rate, you're getting like three times the value out of a piece of hardcover nonfiction. And you could share it with others, although I encourage you not to do that.
And the book you should read but not share with your friends is American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. We'll be back with more from author Paul Greenberg in a minute. Coming up, Oh, the Things You'll Learn About Oysters. For KUOW 94.9 Seattle and Speakers Forum, I'm John O'Brien.
It's 9:20, KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Jack Walters. Legendary singer Aaron Neville talks about his solo career and his work with the Neville Brothers. That's 40 minutes away tonight in the 10 o'clock hour.
Support for KUOW comes from Bellevue Arts Museum, presenting Folding Paper, The Infinite Possibilities of Origami, on view through September 21st. Works by folders from around the world showcase origami's modern-day applications. Details at bellevuearts.org.
A reminder, you can follow KUOW on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You'll find links to our social media accounts at KUOW.org. Just look for the words connect with us.
Support for KUOW comes from Temple Dehersh Sinai's Refresh 5775, a New Year's celebration outside the walls of the synagogue. Thursday, September 25th, at Soul Repair on Capitol Hill. Food, drinks, and program at 6 p.m. Not Your Bubby's Rosh Hashanah. More at refresh5775.org.
Welcome back to Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Our guest, Paul Greenberg, writes regularly for the New York Times Magazine, Book Review, and Opinion sections, focusing on fish, aquaculture, and the future of the ocean. Greenberg won the James Beard Award for Writing and Literature for his book, Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food.
The book really is broken up into three parts. And in case you're wondering what it looks like before you buy it, this is what it looks like. Actually, I quite like the cover. My father, who went through basic training here, when he saw it, he got disgusted by it for some reason. I think it was because there's a raw oyster there. And my dad actually was a resident at Bellevue in the 50s. And in the 50s, shellfish poisoning was very common. And it was one of the worst things to encounter as an emergency room doctor was shellfish poisoning because it was so weird and hard to figure out what was going on. But anyway, the book cover sort of amplifies, or whatever that word is, goes through these three creatures. And I start with oysters. So remember I was talking earlier about the Manhattan Bridge. That's the Manhattan Bridge. And underneath it are oyster saloons. This is around 1910, 1920. Once upon a time, the average New Yorker ate 600 local New York City grown oysters per year. Oysters were so cheap in New York City that they had this thing called the Canal Street Plan, which was all the oysters you could eat for a sixpence. And as I think Mark Herlansky told me once, when people ate too many oysters on their Canal Street plan and the bartender kind of wanted to cut him off, they would slip him a bad oyster, and that was the end of the all-you-can-eat special. Then it went in the other direction. Needless to say, though, you know, people didn't always, I mean, this crowd, it's a fishy crowd, it's a knowing crowd, and we have in the back of our minds this idea that, ugh, raw oysters, maybe not. People 150 years ago didn't really necessarily have that idea. And they didn't have that idea because their estuaries were something that they could believe in. They believed that the waters next door were not a waste disposal system, that they were a food system. When the settlers came here to New York, they found incredible reefs of oysters. There were something like several trillion oysters in the New York Bight, enough oysters to turn the entire water column over every few weeks to filter out all sorts of things like microalgae. And so the water was a lot clearer, it was a lot cleaner, and oysters were part of a sort of positive feedback loop in that you ate the oysters, they were good, you wanted more oysters to be there because you could eat them. And therefore, you keep the water clean. So that worked for a while. Up until about 1820, all the oysters we ate in New York were wild. But by 1820, we had mined them all out. Nevertheless, oysters are super cheap to grow. I mean, I'm always talking, you know, in the last book, in Four Fish, I talked a lot about aquaculture and what's called feed conversion ratios. In other words, how many pounds of X do you have to get to put in to get a pound of Y? In the case of, like, Atlantic salmon, at the beginning of aquaculture for salmon, it took 6 pounds of wild fish ground up to make a pound of salmon. For oysters, it takes nothing to get a pound of oysters. It just takes some algae in the water, which is what makes them so incredibly miraculous. Well, anyway, because you didn't really have to put anything in the water to grow oysters, people grew oysters like gangbusters in New York City, to the point where by around 1900, the oyster industry in up and down the East Coast produce something like 2 billion pounds of oysters per year. You can't even really imagine it. The only way that I can think of to get the modern seafood eater to understand how much oysters we ate is to think about the next generation, which is today, shrimp is our number one consumed seafood. We used to eat as many pounds of oysters per capita as today we eat shrimp per capita. But things went wrong. New York, by the turn of the century, was putting 600 million gallons of sewage into the water every day. Some of the oyster beds were buried in sludge up to 10 feet deep. And then around the 1870s, 1880s, people started to associate oysters with disease, and they started to do it scientifically. Before, it was just sort of a miasma that might come over you in the presence of an oyster. But eventually, it was actually realized that typhoid, hepatitis, all sorts of other diseases could be traced to dirty water and dirty oysters. And once that happened, oyster beds were closed one after the other. And once that happened, then the really bad stuff happened. Heavy metals, all this effluent from industry. Eventually, during the Vietnam War, Agent Orange was produced on the shores of New Jersey. And what happened to the byproduct, dioxins, went right into the water. This is what happens when you let a food system become a waste disposal system. And so if you look at the oyster industry, I mean, look at that drop-off from the 1890s to 1972. That little uptick after 1972 is the Clean Water Act. And what we've seen, actually, since the Clean Water Act in 1972 is a gradual, very small resurrection of the oyster industry. And now, where we were at 1% of historical capacity with eastern oysters, now we're at 14%. All those buck oyster specials that you're seeing, you see them here. We just had some buck oysters. Or was it anchovies and olives? We had some very nice buck oyster specials. That just wouldn't exist 10, 15 years ago. It's the momentum of the Clean Water Act that is allowing all these oysters to go back into the water, to become productive, to have things like Taylor Shellfish Farms, which, you know, really fought really, really intense battles in the 50s against polluters like the Rainier Corporation that was dumping tons and tons of really bad stuff into the waters around the Olympic Peninsula. So this is a really, really major shift that happened to America's seafood industry. And it's not just the oyster farming world, it's the wild oysters. We've lost 80% of our wild oyster reefs. And that's really significant. People who are starting to do oyster restoration projects now, there's one guy who's quoted in the book, a guy named Bob Rowe, R-H-E-A-O-A-U-L-T, but it's pronounced Rowe, and he made his nickname Skid, so no one would mispronounce his name. So he's Bob Skid Row, another Bobby. Bob Skid Row. But Bob was telling me that in the early 80s, he started his first oyster lease in Rhode Island, and he said basically, we had 2 acres of black, anoxic, sludgy bottom, lifeless to the core. Within 2 years, it had become the most dynamic and viable dive site in Rhode Island. People would come from miles away to scuba dive because of the lobsters, the striped bass, all the incredible stuff that oysters brought into their lives. So that's, you know, a very hopeful thing, I think. I think the tide is really turning on oysters, but we still have a lot more to go. I loved seeing the buck oyster specials in the stores and the restaurants everywhere now. I'd like to see a 25-cent oyster special. That's when I know that we've really done something and that things have really changed. So that's oysters. Next up is shrimp. So shrimp, as I said, is the most consumed seafood in America, and we eat as much shrimp as salmon and tuna, the next most popular combined. But this wasn't always the case. It used to be that shrimp was a very kind of regional, local thing. And a lot of us, I think, associate shrimp with the bayou, with Louisiana. And actually, in fact, the first real shrimp industry in this country was a little far south from here in San Francisco Bay. Chinese immigrants who had escaped from the gold trade and from the railroad trade started shrimp operations around San Francisco Bay. They fished for a species called the San Francisco Bay shrimp. They dried them. They exported them back to China and to Chinatowns all over America. Meanwhile, over in Louisiana, they were eating shrimp too. This shrimp is not the shrimp that we eat today, but it's the shrimp that the original Cajuns eat. This shrimp is called Macrobrachium ohione. Macrobrachium meaning large arm, and you see that arm descending from there. So this shrimp was the original shrimp of the bayou. And unlike Gulf shrimp that we're used to eating today, it didn't really live in the Gulf. It actually went the other direction. It swam up the Mississippi River all the way to the Ohio River, a 2,000-mile round trip in just a year. This was the original shrimp of the bayou. It really doesn't exist in commercial quantities anymore, but once upon a time it did. Well, what happened to it? Corn happened to it. The Mississippi Valley is a tremendously fertile territory. The Mississippi actually drains the Rockies on one side and the Appalachians on the other, and the floodplain was once 200 miles wide. The river meandered back and forth, was very slow, and that slow meander allowed the shrimp to migrate on this very slow pathway all the way up to the Ohio River. Well, because we wanted to grab that floodplain and turn it into land food, we did things like this. These are the Greenville Bends in the Mississippi River. The river, as you can see, meanders. And the reason rivers meander, actually, it has to do with the Coriolis effect. The earth turns, it bends the river, and then the river tries to bend back, and then the earth keeps turning and it bends and it keeps bending in the other direction. So we get this sort of zigzaggy effect, which is really good for an ecosystem because it's slow, it's slack, it allows nutrients to drop out. It's a really, really good ecosystem. But as you can see on my picture there, those cutoffs that they made in the 1920s after the Great Flood basically straightened the river and made the river from a meandering, slow affair where nutrients would drop out into a fire hose that just shot nutrients out into the Gulf of Mexico. And that pretty much did in the Mississippi River shrimp. Along with that, though, have also been these amazing inundations or incursions into wetlands. So salt marsh is one of these great ecosystems that nobody knows about. I was thinking, like, there's a funny PR agency in San Francisco called Upwell, and they call themselves the publicists for the ocean. And I've been trying to sell them on this slogan. I want to have a T-shirt that says, "It's the salt marsh, stupid." I don't know. It's probably not going to work. But salt marsh are these incredibly viable or vibrant ecosystems. They sequester more carbon per acre than tropical rainforests, more than any other ecosystem on the planet. And 70% of our commercial seafood species require salt marsh for their existence. Meanwhile, we've lost something like 60 to 70% of our salt marsh in the last 100 years. Again, it's an infrastructure issue. We are undermining the infrastructure of this country's seafood production. And you can see it right there in the Gulf of Mexico. That's Louisiana, and that's the predicted salt marsh lowland loss that's going to happen between now and 2050. We're losing the Mississippi Delta at a rate of a football field an hour. Really, really serious problem. There are actually very real possibilities to rebuild some of that marsh. There is a chance to do it. I've seen some of this stuff. It's all in the book. You can read it. But it's a very serious problem. And we're not noticing it. And we're not noticing it because we have something else that's sort of deadening our feelings about what's going on. And that something is farmed shrimp. So shrimp are critically dependent upon salt marsh in the Mississippi Delta and deltas like it around the south. However, even though we are potentially losing the heartland of American shrimp, we're not hearing it because people came along in the 1940s and 50s and developed shrimp aquaculture. So Dr. Masaru Fujinaga was one of the sort of original founders of this. He was a really interesting guy. He was a visionary. He was a great internationalist. He was sort of came out of his graduate school as the war in Japan was ending, and he really saw the sort of pointlessness of nationalism. So he hired a lot of graduate students from all over the world and set about domesticating shrimp. Now, the original shrimp that he sought to domesticate was something called the Karuma prawn. Whenever you start to do an aquaculture project, people are always pulled by two things. On the one hand, they want to feed the world. You know, oh, if we only could tame salmon, we could feed so many people. On the other hand, they're like, I kind of like to make some money. So they always kind of cast about for creatures out there that kind of work in a financial kind of way. So he focused in on this thing called the Karuma prawn. The Karuma prawn was used in a dish called dancing shrimp. What we would do to eat to make dancing shrimp, you take a live shrimp and you'd rip the carapace off, dip it in sake, and pop it in your mouth while it was still alive. And the dance would end in a horrible way down your throat. Of course, if you're going to have dancing shrimp, you need to have proximity to live shrimp. And that's where Dr. Fujinaga realized, wow, if I could domesticate these things, they were going for the equivalent of $100 a pound. He could do really quite well. And he succeeded. But then his graduate students went and fanned out across all of Southeast Asia and did it with other kinds of shrimp. The tiger prawn was the next one that really got going gangbusters in the early 70s. And then it was the white lake shrimp. And now actually something like 80% of the shrimp that we eat, even though there are a couple of thousands of species of shrimp in the world, 80% of the shrimp that we eat is from a single species, the Pacific white lake shrimp. So why is this a problem? Well, this is a mangrove forest. Took this picture in Vietnam. And this is the way coastal wetlands of Vietnam should look. They should have these amazingly complicated forests. And actually, mangrove forests are really good for the production of wild seafood. They're really, really wonderful, wonderful ecosystems. In fact, this place here was so rich in wildlife that I was told to hold on to my backpack because the monkeys would come and try and steal the backpacks off of your back. It was really, really intense kind of place. So this is the way that Southeast Asia really should look. But this is the way it actually looks. These are shrimp ponds. So shrimp ponds proliferated in the 70s and into the 80s. And two things happened. First of all, people wanted to grow a lot of shrimp, so they dug a lot of ponds. But the other problem that came along is that shrimp are so ancient that they don't really have an immune system. So if you pack them in really densely and a disease breaks out, you're going to have a really serious problem. Mangrove forests were felled. Shrimp were stocked. Diseases occurred, antibiotics were put into the ponds, and sometimes these ponds became so sort of diseased or flocculent that the best thing to do was to abandon them and to move on to another pond. And so we've lost acre after acre of mangrove forest because of our appetite for shrimp. And I always find it ironic that I mentioned Agent Orange earlier, right? You know, Agent Orange, if you know those old enough to remember the Vietnam War or the major issues of it, Agent Orange was a defoliant, and it was used to destroy mangrove canopies all over South Vietnam so we could see the enemy. Well, now, after Agent Orange destroyed a lot of the mangrove forests, now we're destroying them again through our appetite for shrimp, only this time the Vietnamese are willingly selling them to us. And meanwhile, the byproducts of all that Agent Orange dioxin went into our estuary system and polluted our seafood. So you can see there's really a bad negative cycle going on. And this is the way sort of, you know, this sort of shrimp commodity market has emerged, where 90% of our shrimp is coming to us from abroad on these vast, you know, shrimp producing plants all over Southeast Asia, not just in Vietnam, but also in Thailand. Who here has heard about the recent story of the slavery issue in Thailand? Anybody see that? So yeah, I mean, so I was writing an article for Prevention Magazine, and that they asked me, as they always do in those sort of health magazines, so which is the healthiest shrimp that we should eat? So I cased the joint. You know, I talked to all the people from WWF and everyone, you know, the aquaculture dialogues, the people I talked to, I talked to them. And at the end of it, this is about 3 years ago, they said, the best shrimp to eat is Thai shrimp. That's really where they have the best regulation. It's just really, really excellent. And now we find out that a certain portion of the fish meal that's used to feed the shrimp that we eat is acquired through slave labor. And in addition to that, Thailand last year had an outbreak of a new shrimp disease called early mortality syndrome, and they lost $1 billion in shrimp. So we're pushing these ecosystems super, super hard because we want this cheap shrimp. I think we're pushing them way too hard, and it's a major, major problem in the world. And diseases like this occur all the time. This is a white spot disease, just to give you an idea of sort of what there's all the diseases that have afflicted Asian shrimp. They're sort of nightmare names: white spot, yellow head, early mortality syndrome. I was talking to Tom Douglas, and I was telling him about early mortality syndrome, and he took a gasp. He said, "No, don't worry. It doesn't affect you. It only affects the shrimp." Once you get over 45, early mortality syndrome, it doesn't sound good. But in any case, that's the story with shrimp. Well. And you can see the shrimp just bursting through the seams, becoming more and more of our food. Well, the thing is, it isn't necessarily all gloom and doom. You know, we've had all of this foreign product like pouring into our country, and we actually in this country did have a very serious problem with overfishing. A lot of this foreign product came into this country at a time when we had overfished many stocks, and people, we actually did need an outside source of seafood to meet our needs. But something interesting has happened in the last 20 years. So the reason, you know, people always kind of think that once a fish is overfished, that's it. You know, there's no going back from overfish. But you can un-overfish a fish that's been overfished, if you follow what I'm saying. The reason we got into this overfishing situation, I mentioned at the top of the talk that the United States controls more ocean than any country on Earth. Well, the reason we control all that ocean is because we basically made a grab for it. After World War II, people realized that owning the ocean or controlling the ocean was kind of key to national interests. And one by one, countries started declaring what's called an exclusive economic zone out to 200 miles from shore. They did this country after country, and the United States finally did it around 1976. But after they did it, after we declared, oh, we're going to have 200 miles out from shore, somebody, I think, in the Navy was like, guys, we don't kind of have the warships to patrol out to 200 miles around our entire coasts. And then I think somebody probably from NOAA or the Department of Commerce said, I know, we can send some fishermen there. And they did. We subsidized fishing to a tremendous degree in the 70s and into the 80s, and we got what we paid for. And I often think, you know, fishermen often take it on the chin as being the people who went out there and raped the ecosystem and did all these terrible things. But they were encouraged to do it. We paid them to build up their fleets and catch more fish. And surprise, surprise, we had an overfishing situation. And this is just, you know, George's Bank Haddock is a key example. Look at that trough from about 1972 on until about 1995. Well, 1995 and 96 marks this really interesting moment where we passed new fisheries legislation, an addendum onto our Magnuson-Stevens Act called the Sustainable Fisheries Act. And this addendum mandated that we define overfishing when it's happened, we determine which stocks are overfished, and we make a rebuilding plan for rebuilding them. And guess what? It worked. Today we have rebuilt over 30 different stocks of fish in this country. It's an amazing, amazing thing that we've done. But meanwhile, we're sending about a third of what we catch abroad, while we're importing all this farm stuff that is coming from these dubious places. So who is reaping the benefit of our tremendous fisheries rebuilding program? Not us. Other countries are reaping the benefit largely. And I think that's something that really needs to change.
Stay tuned for more from author Paul Greenberg on Speakers Forum. Coming up, what happened to all the salmon? And why are people from Connecticut so uptight? From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.
943 KUOW 94.9.
KUOW and Seattle's Chinatown International District present Seattle's Night Market and Moon Festival with food trucks, crafts, carnival games, a breakdance competition, and an outdoor dance party. September 13th from 6 p.m. to midnight on the Union Station Plaza in the Chinatown ID. More on the events page at KUOW.org.
Support for KUOW comes from the YWCA Seattle King Snohomish, celebrating 120 years young, dedicated to building a strong community by eliminating racism and empowering women since 1894. Learn more at YWCAWorksAnnualReport.org.
KUOW, find us online at KUOW.org.
Join KUOW and ACT Theater for The Invisible Hand. From the author of The War Within and American Dervish comes one of Ayad Akhtar's latest plays about the complexities of global conflict. September 5th through the 28th. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, this is part three of today's Speakers Forum with Paul Greenberg. Next up, the sockeye salmon migration, impending ecological challenges, and a reverie on our lost Neptunian democracy.
That brings me to the sort of final third of the talk. I always say, you know, remember in university or high school when somebody said, I'm going to talk about three things today. And when you got to the third one, you're like, oh, thank God. Well, we've reached that point, ladies and gentlemen. So, you know, salmon used to be something that was, if not common, it occurred on both of our coasts. Salmon on the east coast of North America and in Europe migrated from their natal rivers out to the waters off of Greenland and Iceland, and they came back. And it's often said that in Scotland, for example, you know how you often hear the story that prisoners rioted in New England because they didn't want to be fed lobster again? It's also apparently true of Scottish prisoners and salmon. There was that much salmon. Well, what happened to all that salmon? So this is my home state of Connecticut. I can say this because I'm from Connecticut, but well, so every point on that map of Connecticut is a dam. There are 3,000 dams in the state of Connecticut alone. I often say that this is why people in Connecticut are so uptight. Connecticut's chi is blocked. Can we please unblock Connecticut's chi? Please. But, you know, it's interesting. So I showed this slide at a conference I was doing down North Carolina. And afterwards, a guy came up to me, sort of sidled up to me. He says, you know, you know, Paul, you ought to be not so hard on your Connecticut. I said, why is that? He says, well, we here in North Carolina, we got 35,000 dams. So we have just dams everywhere. The U.S. has 75,000 dams and several million smaller obstructions. And what do those dams do? They obstruct what are called diadromous fish, fish that go from fresh to salt. And it really is, our chi is truly blocked. The flow of energy from fresh water to salt water is being blocked. And we've lost run upon run, not just of salmon, but of herring, of alewives, of shad, of eels. All these things, if you look at the old New York City menus, you see eel after eel, shad after shad, herring after herring, because we ate from the near shore. Well, there is a place out there where there are still unimpeded rivers and amazing salmon runs. So this is Bristol Bay, Alaska. Who here has been to Alaska? It's always fun to ask that question in the Pacific Northwest. You know, hands just shoot up. It's like, oh, I go to Alaska all the time. in New York, you're like, they're like, yeah, I had wanted to go to Alaska. But then I had a condition. I had a herniated disc and then, you know, whatever. But here you actually go to Alaska. So Bristol Bay is this amazing, amazing place. It's the site of our country's largest, in fact, the world's largest sockeye salmon run. As many as 40 million sockeye come into the system every year. And you see off to the side there, that lake there, that's Lake Iliamna. And Lake Iliamna, at any one time, contains a billion fish. It's the great sort of powerhouse lake of Bristol Bay salmon runs. Sockeye are unusual, a little bit unusual in that they require a lake in their migration process. They'll come down, they'll hang out in the lake, they'll go out, they'll come back, they maybe hang out at the lake again. And there are different kinds of sockeye. They're check one, check two, check three, depending on how much time they're going to spend in that lake. Very, very critical to salmon biology to have these pristine, pure, beautiful lakes. And I got to experience this amazing lake through fishing. I saw a lot of hands go up as fishermen. So, you know, the idea of getting to go to Alaska is like just the ultimate fantasy for somebody from the East Coast. When, as a divorced dad kid, my dad got me a subscription to Field & Stream. And when we would see him every other weekend, I would bring him the back page with lodges circled. Like, look at only 3,000 a week, you know. And he's like, no, we're not going to do that. So anyway, I finally got to go to Alaska. And so I throw this up here. Those of you who are fly fishermen will recognize this as being a fly. And typically flies imitate bugs or sometimes they imitate minnows. You're trying to trick the fish into eating something that it normally eats. Well, this fly is called a flesh fly. It simulates rotting flesh falling off the carcass of a salmon. That's how common salmon are in this system. And there are so many salmon that a lot of sport fishermen, including Bristol Bay, don't even really bother with the salmon. You know, anglers always want something rare and effete and hard to get. And what they're really after is this. That's a rainbow trout that I caught just fishing off the dock, you know, in Alaska. And these fish are so incredibly full of the power and the energy of these amazing salmon. So the guide was very kind enough to pose for the picture with me, hold the fish for me. But the fish was still so powerful after fighting against 15-knot current that it did this. It slipped out of his hands. And it kept going. And it kept going. And it kept going. That is not Photoshop. This guide was amazing. He actually did, that fish did not hurt itself. He caught the fish and it managed to release it safely. And as soon as he put it in the water, the fish was like, it just disappeared. Amazing, amazing fish. So, you know, you hold this fish. When you catch a trout in New York State, it's like, I'm a trout. I'm from the hatchery. You could eat me if you want, I don't know, or put me back, I'm just going to die. But this thing was just like full, it was like, you know, just pure, pure energy. And it's pure energy, not only for the sportsmen, but for the commercial guys. So this was just a typical day during the height of the sockeye run. I have to say, I particularly love the Bristol Bay sockeye because the typical peak is July 4th, which is my birthday. And on my birthday, everybody goes away. On my birthday, though, this fish comes. So I kind of think of it as like, you know, this is really my favorite fish. And you can see, like, it's just like, you know, look at these, you know, is that GQ or what? this, you know, amazing guys. And also, you know, I didn't have them in the shop, but also just strapping beautiful women. It's just like an amazing, amazing fishery where these people really work hard, follow the rules, catch this really, really lovely fish. And it's a delight. And it all comes from this amazing ecosystem. But look what's coming down the pike. Boo. These are mining claims in this area. And, you know, to some degree, the structure of my book is that oysters are the past, shrimp are the present, and Bristol Bay sockeye are the future. They really represent this huge choice that we have ahead of us. So many, many mineral claims in this area. The biggest, of course, is something called Pebble Mine. It is a strike that is worth somewhere between $300 and $500 billion. The strike contains about 10 billion tons of ore that would have to be sifted through in situ because there are no real roads there. And then all of that slag, or the tailings, I should say, which is sulfurous. There's actually Rick Halford, who's this great Republican senator who kind of went off the rails and just can't stand this mine. He used to say he never met a mine that he didn't approve until this one came across his path. But he likes to say that if you were to call this mine by what it really is, it would be a sulfur mine. And of course, sulfur doesn't do very good things for salmon. Actually, copper doesn't do very good things for salmon. Copper in the water in very, very small concentrations is enough to throw salmon's ability to migrate off. It's like, you know how when you put a magnet on a compass and the compass goes off? That's kind of what copper does to a salmon. So all this is happening, or not happening yet, all this is being proposed. It would be a 10 billion ton mine. And guess what? Also, it's a seismic area. There are earthquakes in this area pretty much all the time. There would be a 2,000-foot retaining lake, possibly, that would have to be put in situ to hold all the tailings, and it would be surrounded, theoretically, by earthen dams that would hopefully hold all this stuff together. And when the EPA took a look at this, they determined that in order for this whole project to work, it would require on-site remediation in perpetuity. I mean, how do you do that? I always imagine, like, 10,000 years from this, like, you got to remediate that. You know, how is he even going to know that, you know, he was responsible for this in some kind of way, shape, or form? So, interestingly, though, there has actually been a really strong fight to try and stop this mine. And the commercial guys and the sport guys, for the first time, are really kind of on the same side. They're usually at each other's throats. But this time around, they really see this as for what it is, a fight for this key piece of our heritage, key piece of our nutrition, and key piece for our health and even our dignity. It's a really, really big fight. So, you know, if there's one message that I would leave with you, it's no to Pebble Mine. Thank you. Right now there's something called the 404C process that's part of the Clean Water Act. If the EPA determines that there is a spawning ground or a shellfish ground of national significance, they can enact federal legislation or federal controls to keep those areas out of industrial production. And that process has sort of creeping ahead and might actually go through, but it could be a waiting game between this administration and the administration to come and what they will think of what to do with Pebble Mine. So I thought I'd leave you here, though, with just a little couple of pages from the book itself. And this all came to me. This is Reed Ten Clay out there on Graveyard Point in Bristol Bay pulling in some sockeye. And this image to me is like, you know, I took this picture, so I'll praise it. I just thought it was like almost like a kind of pietà or some sort of just amazing kind of, you know, Renaissance scene of labor, of good labor. Of yeoman's work, well applied to feed the country. And it got me to thinking about where we stood as seafood overall. To eat from dry land, we humans are compelled to tame the countryside, till and fertilize it, kill off pests, and fence off territory, to grind and process and flavor, add nutrients, subtract fat, shape and mold until that increasingly artificial land food becomes something, not quite food. At sea, everything is a miracle by comparison. All that the sea asks of us is that we be wise in our harvest, recognize the limits of its bounty, and protect the places where seafood wealth is born. In return, the sea will feed us and make us smarter, healthier, and more resilient. Quite a covenant. With dinner stowed away, I took a walk around the old cannery grounds of Graveyard Point while the polar sun circled in the nightless summer sky. This was a place where industrial fishing had once turned a dynamic wild animal into a faceless commodity product that traveled the world in a can. I thought of the particularly contemporary American reworking of those bad times that was happening here today, a small group of committed artisan fishermen doing something very different, a group that fished modestly, followed the rules, caught what could be sustained, and formed their own pact with American fish eaters to the south, fish eaters who wanted to know what they were eating, how it was caught, and how the people who caught it led their lives. Passing up to a bluff, I looked down on the isolated little settlement washed by the foam of the Bering Sea, and thought that once upon a time, a little 17th century village, fishing village, called New Amsterdam, must have looked quite a bit like this. A modest place with its face turned toward the sea, where the fisherman and the fishmonger were an integral part of daily life, and where seafood held its own with land food in every regard. What kind of alternate future might America have had if the descendants of New Amsterdam had decided that seafood, not land food, would be the new country's bread and butter? Not a Jeffersonian society that relied upon the harvests of agriculture, nor a Hamiltonian one that captained banking and industry, but rather a Neptunian democracy that lived off the sea, a place where estuaries were recognized as the heart of the food system, where rivers were rarely fettered for fear of impeding the miraculous runs of salmon, sturgeon, shad, and herring, where human development moved in parallel with the protection of the near shore. What kind of society might we have formed had we not, as Melville wrote in Moby Dick, become, quote, landsmen, tied to counters, nailed to benches, clinched to desks? What if instead we had become what Melville called a society fixed in ocean reveries? Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a talk by author Paul Greenberg. His new book is American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. In his recent article, 10 Things You Should Know About the American Seafood Supply, Greenberg writes, "Much of the wild salmon caught in Alaska is exported. Meanwhile, most of the salmon Americans eat is farmed and imported, mostly from Chile. Salmon are not native to Chile or to anywhere in the southern hemisphere, and in some instances are considered an invasive species. Overall, we send abroad about 3 billion pounds of mostly wild seafood every year, about a third of the total American catch." Paul Greenberg spoke at Town Hall Seattle on July 10th, 2014. Thanks to Sam Kohler for this recording. To listen again to this talk or pass it along to a friend, navigate over to our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. And while you're there, let us know what upcoming talks you'd like us to feature. For Speakers Forum, I'm John O'Brien, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Arts West, presenting the Seattle premiere of The Mountaintop by Katori Hall. During the reimagined eve of his assassination, Dr. King grapples with his legacy and humanity. September 11th through October 5th. Tickets and information at artswest.org.
It's 10 o'clock. This is KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Pacific Continental Bank, working to strengthen communities by helping businesses and nonprofits succeed. Learn more at therightbank.com. Pacific Continental Bank, focused on business, passionate about community.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.